Good morning. My name is Terry Wright, and I'm the director of the Center for Public Health Policy at the American Public Health Association, as well as the Center for School Health and Education. I welcome you this morning to this session and to let you know that the Center for School Health and Education sponsored this session, which is something that we do for different programs out there that we think are important and strategic to our work. The focus of this session today will be on the social determinants of health and how different communities have wrestled with them. And these are colleagues and grantees of the Kresge Foundation. So I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Phyllis Meadows, who is a senior fellow at the Kellogg Foundation. And again, want to thank you for coming to our sponsored session.
Well, thank you, Dr. Wright, and thanks to APHA, and welcome to each and every one of you for bearing the cold weather to come out this morning. On behalf of the Kresge Foundation, and I know our K's get mixed up, I have a history with Kellogg, and I have a history with Kresge, but I'm very pleased. Yeah, you did.
I
do it all the time. I did.
We were
at the Kellogg Foundation together many moons ago, so that's a natural mistake. But anyway, I want to take a brief moment to share just a little background about the wonderful work of our Safety Net Enhancement Grantees. That's the name of the group and the cluster of work that we launched about 4 years ago. Let's see our evaluator. The Kresge Foundation funded this effort to really explore population-based approaches and models to reduce health inequities in vulnerable communities. Clearly, we were really looking for impacts and strategies that could address some of the social and environmental conditions that impact health. Your panel today includes four of the eight communities that we funded, and these are communities from all over the country. But we had a very strong commitment when we started this initiative. We had three major goals. One, we wanted to support communities in their efforts to address some of the social and environmental conditions that impacted health and that persisted in impacting health in their communities. Secondly, we wanted to foster multi-sector partnerships because we know that's an important way to get the work done. But further, we wanted to engage communities, local communities, in prioritizing and making decisions about how they can address those health conditions. And then third, we were hoping that we could develop some new models, new ways of thinking, new ways of behaving across sectors and through partnerships that could improve health or place communities on the pathway to health. I was having a discussion this morning with my new friend, who I'm going to introduce to you in a moment, and I was saying that, you know, these are really problems that we've been talking about for a long time. I've been in public health for about 30 years, and sometimes you feel like the problems are just repeating themselves. And he reminded me very kindly that these are tough problems. They're hard work, and I'm excited that today you're going to hear about a courageous group of people who did work and did try to address these issues as tough as they are. Wanted to let you know that we funded 8 projects across the country. And when we did this initiative, we were hoping to get sites that were in rural communities, that were in urban communities, and urban particularly because that's a commitment of the foundation. As you hear our tagline, we have a strong commitment to improving the well-being in urban settings. So that's across the lifespan. So each of the groups of partners that you are going to hear from today, and some of those that are across the country, had identified the communities where they wanted to work in. They had identified the target populations who they wanted to serve. They were responsible for identifying the core partners with whom they would work, and they had the tough challenge of identifying one health disparity that they wanted to work on and use this process to move. So I'd like to introduce our moderator for today, and I think I have his intro somewhere here. Excuse me. So our moderator today, we're very excited. Many of you may have seen that we had Craig Folley, who is a PBS, had a PBS news program in Detroit. And Craig was not able to be here, and luckily we had conversations with our moderator, and he agreed to take this on, and we are so excited to have Spencer Michaels as your moderator. Spencer is a health journalist for PBS's NewsHour. He is a graduate of Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs and holds a master's from Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. His work has taken him to Israel, to Vietnam, to European cities, and other places around the world. And he's just a smart, committed, and just real good-looking, too, individual. We're glad that he could be here today, and I'll step aside and let him introduce the panelists and guide us through this conversation that we want to have with you this morning. Spencer.
Thank you. That's an old picture. Well, it's really a great pleasure to be here in New Orleans, and it's a little ironic that we're going to talk about food deserts. This is not the place to do that. I've had to learn a lot in the last couple of weeks about community health partnerships. As a news person, my job is to demystify programs and goals and language, avoid lingo and abbreviations, and try to explain and talk about these things so we're all on the same page. That said, we really want to figure out how these community health partnerships work or don't work and what we can learn. Kresge has sponsored, as Phyllis says, 8 sites. We're going to focus on 4 of them today. What should be the role of the community health center in addressing health disparities? Excuse me. How important is leadership? How do you get the community involved, and how can multi-sector partnerships work? Who are valuable partners and who are not? And we're talking about partners, we're talking about community agencies and governments and health centers and so forth that work with the program. So a quick introduction, just so we know who's here. Briefly, Amanda Guy directs community health programs in Flagstaff, Arizona. Dana Harvey is from Alameda County, California, where she's executive director of Mandela Marketplace and Food to Families. Crystal Palmer runs wellness initiatives in Roxbury, part of Boston. And Lucille Smith is executive director of Voices of Detroit Initiative. Now I'm going to give you a little more about each one of their programs. Excuse me. And then we'll talk each one of them. And then we'll have a discussion, and then we'll take questions from the audience. And hidden in the program is a short slideshow, which we'll show you a little bit later. So Amanda Guy from Flagstaff, Arizona, is Director of Community Health Programs and Services of North County Healthcare. The project is called Hermosa Vida. Near one elementary school with a largely Native American and Hispanic student body in Flagstaff, parents were afraid to let their kids out of the dwellings. The park nearby was overrun by drunks and derelicts. Arizona had passed a controversial law, SB 1070, which allowed law enforcement to ask people with brown skin for their papers. The Immigration Service was in the neighborhood, the story went, so keep the kids inside. That and other problems led to an amazing lack of physical activity by everybody. The school put in a tennis court, which nobody wanted. They wanted a basketball court. So the agency had plenty to do. For one thing, police moved the inebriates out of the parks. The all-too-familiar Zumba classes started up, for which they now charge $1. Physical activity was stressed at recess time in school. So bringing healthy produce to the neighborhood was another approach via a school produce market. 29 grants and programs were coordinated at the clinic site. Amanda Guy had plenty to do bringing together all these programs and all these problems. 29 different partners almost. That seems like a lot to deal with. How did you do it? Yeah.
Well, so we actually ended up having some partners that started with us with the planning phase of the grant. So something that Cresta did that was incredible was they provided us a 9-month planning period. And during the 9-month planning period, we were able to do community engaged research and really engage community members in what the health disparity was, identifying the health disparity, investigating it, and then determining the strategies we would put in place to try to address it. And so some of those partners from the get-go were, for instance, the Healthy Kids, Fit Kids from the local hospital, some very natural partners with the county health department and the local parks and rec department. But some unlikely partners started to emerge, and those partners included the local food security, because when you're talking about food abundance, oftentimes there's food insecurity considerations as well. And so we really ended up getting some unlikely and incredible partners along the way. And it just ended up being something that so many partners with vast interests ended up wanting to be involved with and engaged with and engage this particular community, not just the school and the residents around the school, because it was a school that was the heart of the community, but also the community at large in engaging and talking about everything from food to physical activity and the immigration status.
But it must be a little bit tricky, you would think, dealing with a bunch of partners, some of whom probably are pretty good and you get along with, and some of whom are not. How do you negotiate and navigate through the nervousness of telling some partner, you know, maybe you're not right for us?
Great question. You know, he didn't let us know what Houston we have. I would say that one of the best things that happened, and I think it was just one of those projects that happened in, you know, hopefully more than once in your lifetime, because the people that came together around this particular initiative all had a place in their hearts for making this work. And I think one of the best things about it was that we had a steering committee from the get-go that was involved in the planning phase, was involved in the community engagement, heard the community say what they wanted to have happen. And then from there on out, the steering committee is what we called it, continued to meet and were very transparent about who the dedicated staff were, how much money was available, and how to engage in different scopes of work, what community organization would do this part of the scope of work. And because it was a very complex project with lots of moving parts, different community organizations took the lead on different strategies, and it worked for us.
So did you have to drop some potential partners along the way?
No, that's not what happened.
No?
I would say that over time, I really ended up picking up additional partners.
And coordinating 29 partners, that sounds tricky.
Well, not everybody was in the steering committee. There were other offshoots. So, for instance, the school-based strategies ended up having partners that met just for the school-based strategies. And then there was a policy coalition. The policy coalition ended up having partners that were focused on policy change, focused on making sure that alcohol and 40-ounce weren't sold near the parks and that sort of thing. So there were, you know, different entities that were really focused and working on different strategies.
Okay, so we're going to move on. Obviously, it brings up a lot of things to talk about, and we'll try to get to them as we go on, but I want everybody to have a chance here. Dana Harvey, who's sitting next, runs a program in Alameda County, California, that's essentially Oakland, called Food for Families, and she's also the guiding light of Mandela Marketplace, a community produce stand. The neighborhood is a food desert. It's nearly 100% African American. Getting folks to take part and stay in the program was difficult, though there did seem to be demand for information and help with stress, parenting, breastfeeding, and food. Classes were begun in conjunction with the West Oakland Health Center. Coupons for health food, actually food prescriptions, were initiated, though the county didn't participate in the effort, and farmers markets were excluded. unlike a very successful program in Connecticut that some of you may know about. A $60 a month incentive was offered to those taking part. Dana told me that 10 women, stayed with the program for 2 years, which I want to ask about, because it doesn't sound like a huge number. Dana told me that the bureaucracy in the area often got in the way of implementing the program. The original concept was that the public health department would be a spark to get the program going. Altogether, 70 organizations were involved, but there were classes in parenting, meditation, massage, but there were bumps along the way, and the cooperation sometimes faltered. Dana can explain that. The program is unfinished, and Dana and her staff hope to keep it going. So there were some bumps along the way.
I'm scared, though. Lots of caveats to what you just said.
Okay, well, go ahead and correct.
There were some bumps along the way, but I guess, Mandela Marketplace, we are a nonprofit organization, and we really work in this nexus of community health and economic development, which is a challenging spot, but what I think we see and that aligns a lot with public health is that to address issues of public health, you've really got to get to the economy of people. And addressing the issues of poverty is really important. So I'm just going to put that out in the beginning. And then what Cressy did that was so innovative, especially for a foundation, and what the public health department did that was so innovative in the beginning, was they also had a 9-month planning period, and the public health department created the Building Blocks Collaborative. And that's where the 70 partners sort of came together through the Building Blocks Collaborative. When it came time then to actually tease out a project from this amazing collection of different organizations and agencies and community residents who were also part of this collaborative, we looked at all of, everyone talked about, we have to find out what the needs are. So we decided that there had already been a lot of data collected, and let's look at what rose to the top. So what rose to the top was jobs and food. So our organization was a natural fit for moving the project forward. So in moving the project forward, we really wanted to hold that initial value of having multiple partners involved. So we designed this idea of working with the health clinic and working with our nonprofit to have the food prescriptions and food access at our retail sites.
Would you explain what a food prescription is? That's an interesting concept.
So the health clinic that we worked with is in West Oakland, and the nutritionists or the nurses, when they saw clients, they would say, okay, I'm prescribing to you that you need to eat more kale and more yellow vegetables. And then we had a little coupon that the women would get, and it would have a list of the different foods that the nurse prescribed for them. They would bring that coupon to one of our retail sites, either corner stores, produce stands, or the food cooperative. And then they could buy those vegetables and fruits at the store, and then check off on their little prescription, I bought eggplant and kale and oranges, and then at the next class, which we held weekly, the women could bring their coupon and sort of check in.
You think it worked?
I think that it needed a little more time. I think that it does work, and I will say that Wholesome Wave in Connecticut had great success with this idea of prescriptions and coupons, and I hope that we can sort of continue this so that we can see. What we really wanted was to see a shift in the BMI of the women, but we didn't really quite have long enough to see that shift.
Okay, well,
I think it worked.
Okay, we'll get more into that. Your original comment that we had to address the problems of poverty is intriguing, because I think that's what this is all about. And how do you start to address the problems of poverty? Except, but we'll get to that in a little bit. Let's talk to Crystal Palmer for a minute. She's the director of Wellness Initiatives, Whittier Health Street Center in Roxbury, which is one of 17
17 neighborhoods
in Boston. Its goal is to build vibrant communities in public housing. So this is a public housing project. Many people in the community were skeptical and reluctant to get into the programs to address the high rates of hypertension and depression among the largely African American and Hispanic residents in Boston public housing. It's a low-income, primarily African-American, Hispanic area, and it's often violent. Crystal told me on the phone when we talked about this at first, we struggled and still struggle every day to recruit people. It's a constant battle. Often she heard people say, you people come in here with programs all the time, and then you leave and nothing has changed. And I'm sure you've all heard that before. One approach that helped was hiring residents of the housing projects, people familiar with the culture and the language. The programs the Kresge Grant supported included nutrition classes, exercise, including Zumba, that seems to be the bottom line for all of this now, life coaching, computer classes, and job referrals. One of the most successful approaches was a summer camp for kids. One problem was getting men to participate. Women would take part, but men were more reluctant. Incentives such as gift cards worth money were used, but haven't been terribly effective. Crystal says that when the program officially ended, having exceeded its goals, there was significant improvement in weight, stress, anxiety, depression among those who took part. But the big question remaining is how to get more folks involved. So why don't you tell us how you can try to get more folks involved, Crystal.
Woody Street has a center, the health center, and it's really important to the
community. Maybe you put that mic a little closer to your
mic. Woody Street has been provided over the last 8 years. Primary assistance in the struggle, a day-to-day struggle, to
let me take off on that just a little bit. You talk about the driver. You came to the program after it had already started, if I remember.
Yes.
How important is a continuity of leadership in these programs? And did that make a difference when you came after the program had already started?
Yes. It was very important to try to keep people engaged despite the changes in nutritionists, life coaches, managers. So it was very important that our the manager, me, and our partner, PHA, continue to work together to keep the residents involved in the program.
And do you have contact with people, with the power structure in the area, with say the mayor or with the city council? How do you navigate that?
Well, our primary partner in this program is the Boston Health Authority. So those are the people that we keep engagement with, the building managers, the leader at the city hall. Those are the people that we stay engaged with. But basically, the key are these residents who reside in the development. Those people are key to bring the state residents to the program.
Okay. So we'll get back to that in a little while. Let me introduce Lucille Smith, who's the Executive Director of Voices of Detroit Initiative, otherwise known as VODI, program designed to help treat diabetes and hypertension on Detroit's northeast side. And you all know about Detroit and its problems over the last decade. Like many low-income areas, Detroit's east side is a food desert. You can't find a supermarket nearby where you can get healthy vegetables and other foods at reasonable prices. And in the winter, Detroit, somewhat like New Orleans, it seems, is cold. It's difficult for seniors and others to walk to a grocery store or even to a health clinic. So how do they access the health services that do exist? The program has 600 members, and one goal has been to empower those people to talk with doctors and dispel many myths about health. Despite the Affordable Care Act, there are still a lot of people who are uninsured. VODI is trying to make it easier to enroll. VODI is working, like all these groups, with a group of partners, and at first the City of Detroit Health Department, which has more problems than you can ever imagine. And they were involved, but that participation has waned. It never really contributed any dollars to the program. The Kresge program is ongoing, and with many of the activities done by other organizations, and Lucille can help us understand how this complex system is organized. Is it the unique situation of Detroit? There are still some constants, though, that apply to a lot of other cities, right, Lucille?
Yes, there are. Although Detroit is in bankruptcy, well, we just came out of bankruptcy last week. Our health department was the city in Detroit. There are local and state health departments, and at one time we had city health departments as well. But Detroit is the only city health department in the state of Michigan because of special legislation, which was based on population. However, the population kept going down in Detroit because of its multiple problems. And so the number of residents that had to be in place in the city has decreased legislatively in order to keep the city health department. But there was an opportunity and concern right before we went into bankruptcy was that we would lose our city health department. We have a county health department. Detroit is located in Wayne County. The county health department was definitely in place, but did not provide services to the city of Detroit. So an Institute for Population Health was established, which is a nonprofit institution. And many of the dollars were supposed to flow from the state and other programs to this Institute for Population Health. However, about 6 months to 8 months into the process, it was determined that it was illegal. That many of the programs, although the city had really disbanded its health department and only had skeleton staff to provide programs that were strictly as quote public health related, those programs were the only thing that remained, such as immunization and epidemiology research.
You wonder a little bit, though, if the fact of the dysfunction of the Detroit Health Department might have been kind of a blessing in disguise. I mean, allowing your program to not have to deal with a superimposed bureaucracy.
No, I don't think that was a blessing in disguise. Voting is the 15-year-old coalition that was established under a Kellogg Foundation grant. So we had multiple provider partners, and the City Health Department was our original partner with voting. Our partners are health systems and community health centers, along with the Health Department and Wayne State and University School of Medicine. So, and we've had great success with the University of Michigan School of Pharmacy. So it was a multi-partners, intersectoral partnership that we had, and we had a great deal of experience with that. We had relied on the health department for primary care services. They used to have community centers where they provided care. So we had a good history. It was devastating to lose that kind of access to care. But we felt the health disparities, we had a lot of information, and one of the important things I should say is that Kresge pushed us to, we had another partner who, a health system, was going to apply, and Kresge pushed us to work together. So partnerships, relationships, have been extremely important in getting things done. And for the community had and providers felt comfortable with voting, holding data related to information about claims, about what kind of services, diagnosis people were using who were unsure, because that is what we originally brought into being for, is to provide care to people who were uninsured and did not have access to care.
Can you be a little bit more specific about your relationship with the clinic itself? I mean, how do you interact with those folks?
All of the clinics, all of the community health centers are members of VOTI, a part of VOTI's coalition, have been for, we are 15, 16 years old, and about 14 of those years, they have been full partners with us. And they provide the primary care. Health systems did not feel that they could provide primary care because they couldn't get paid for it. Health centers could get paid for it, so the division took place in which the health centers provided the primary care and the hospitals provided the ancillary specialty services by partnering with each of the health centers so that there was a continuum of care. Then we ran into a major problem with prescriptions. You can provide care to folks, but if they can't get their medications and the rest. So the City Health Department at one time had a pharmacy, and we provided support. We found some financial support for them to get their pharmacy to function more appropriately and provide prescriptions for us.
So as a layperson looking at this, I'm thinking to myself, here's a pharmacy, here's a health clinic, all set up, been going for a while. A Kresge program comes in and tries to involve itself in all this. One would think there would be jealousies and rivalries. What are you doing in here trying to tell us how to run our show? Does that happen?
Not over uninsured people.
Great answer.
There might be a fight to get rid of them, but not never a fight to provide services. So that's the most difficult part, is finding the incentives for people to work together. But we targeted a 2 zip codes in the northeast part of Detroit. So we didn't try to do this project and just over the entire city. And it has been what we consider to be successful. We've had some starts and when we did our initial assessment with the community, one other thing Christine told us, you already have enough data. So you don't really need to go back and figure out what it is that health problems that they have. You already know that. What you need to do is look and be more innovative about what you're trying to do. So we developed a hub, a centralized campus where people could come, and safety became our determinant of health. Because safety was important as a part of getting access to health care, but also and being able to be more physically fit, more involved in nutrition and everything, safety was a very important part of it.
So let's open it up now to sort of general discussion, and I think where we just left off was a good place to start. The relationship with the other agencies in the community, the police department, the public health department, the schools, the housing authority, etc., etc. How do you get into a community and become part of that without antagonizing the power structure that already exists? Amanda, you want to deal with that? And all of you can talk about it.
Well, and I'd say, once again, going back to the planning phase, I think that what really set us on the right course is that we did a process that is called RARE, which is Rapid Assessment, Research, and Evaluation in a community, to look specifically in a very short amount of time what the community was interested in addressing and why and how we could address it. And then after we had the results and engaged local economists from the work, then we went back to the community to ask them to vote on strategies, and they actually got to vote in a community meeting on the strategies we would put in place if we were to receive the demonstration funding from the Kresge Foundation. And so I think from the get-go, all of the original partners were really engaged in talking with the community about what they'd like to see. And as a result, everyone was on the same page from the beginning because the community is the one that indicated what strategies they would like to put in place and how it would play out.
In Oakland,
I wanted you to follow up
because the situation in Oakland, I happen to know some of the politics there, is a very political city.
Yes, it is.
And how do you get in there and make yourself known?
So I think there were a couple of levels of partnership that were interesting. One is that, you know, I have a very close relationship with a senior staff at Alameda County Public Health. And we've been working together for a long time, so having that close link and a working relationship between a community-based organization and the health department, I think, is key, so that we're working really together. The second level is, as Amanda's experience was, we're a community-based organization that focuses on empowering people in the community, engaging them in identifying what the problems are and what the solutions are, and then resourcing them to implement those solutions. So I think those two levels of, you know, really personal relationships was very important for us. And we did the community engagement about what the issues were, but then we had focus groups and so our program targeted pregnant women at the West Oakland Health Center, and we asked them, what do you need for your families? And they listed a lot of other things besides food. It was stress management and food access and parenting classes and other problems that we were then able to help them address.
Did you have to go higher, though? Did you have to get the city council or somebody to get involved in this, or was there enough going on at the lower level that it would work?
So from my vantage point, you can't get any higher than the community residents that we're targeted to serve.
But you did try to see the mayor at one point.
That wasn't for this project. That was for, I'm happy to tell anyone about that. In our experience, that was around the food co-op business.
Oh, I see.
Venture. But for this project, I think the important piece was that Kresge wanted to say, if we put a health center in the center, and then look at all of the community resources that are addressing health issues, and somehow weave them together to create a healthier environment, then can we shift the issues of poor health? That isn't just about prescriptions or seeing your doctor, but it's about all of these other challenges that we're talking about. So I think holding that as our goal was the important piece. And the funding, I guess the funding made the difference. If we didn't have the money, we wouldn't have been able to do this. So I think having the innovative foundation to come in and tell the county, we want this funded, and the county may not have funded it in the same way. So I think that was really important too.
Crystal, Boston is famous for its politics, its ward politics. You got to know somebody. You don't look Irish. So how do you deal with the power structure, or do you need to?
Well, I agree with Dana. We sort of have this public community level. When the program was piloted, it was very difficult for us to include adults, because during the community discussions, the adults reported that there was just too much going on in their lives. So the program was started somewhere in June, and the way we got to really begin the program was to engage the youth. And that was a great help to the parents who felt that there was just too much going on with all the issues of violence and such. And so we began a camp with about 150 youth. We did football conditioning. The kids were taken to all the cultural places in Boston, a lot of swimming activities and things like that. So we engaged those children, that was 5 to 13, for over the last 4 years. We did have a camp in this past summer. So that's how we sort of handled the potential survivors and the developers. And by having the adults also participate in the wellness programs, exercise programs, and things like that, some of them stated that they no longer feel that their neighbors are their enemies. Simply because they participated in this wellness program that we designed, that the components of exercise, nutrition, and stress management. So we have engaged over 600 residents and over 1,000 altogether with various activities. But in this wellness program that we have to exercise, nutrition, and stress management, we engaged over 600 residents. And so many of them stated that for the first time they're able to come out of their apartments and feel comfortable because they're now part of a family. They no longer fear their neighbors and things like that. So that's how we sort of handle the environment.
That sounds pretty good. And yet some of the numbers that you all talked about with me seemed kind of small, that maybe not enough people. Was the 600 that you engaged, is that optimum, or could you do more, or what?
The program was designed to engage a third of the residents. There were 1,800 families, and we engaged over the last number I saw was 1,224. But in this particular wellness exercise group, we maintained about 600 residents participating in these exercise programs.
Lucille, are you reaching enough people in Detroit?
Well, we're reaching more than we had anticipated. I took while to get there. They have built, like Crystal said, a network. They depend on each other. People who never communicated with each other, next door neighbors, are now, they have a safe place to come. They have a safe place to be able to talk with each other. And about October 22nd, we had a community partner breakfast, and they built their own skit.
And what's the safe place you talked about? Is it a physical spot?
It's a physical spot. It's a campus where a old hospital that is closed was on, and it's owned by St. John Providence Health System, and they are one of our partners. They provide the space for us there, and that's where the people come. They provide the safety, and the community has a they have a group of volunteers who go out and they patrol the streets during school hours and also when we have campus events. There are two senior citizen complexes there, so it's a hub concept. We call it Impact, our Healthy Living Campus. And in the skit, they showed exactly what they do. They go out and they recruit other people. They tell their friends about it. Their friends come, and once they see what's going on, because one of the things they told us in the beginning was that they wanted to, they did not trust their providers. We were really surprised, but they really felt that they didn't trust what they said. They had a lot of home remedies and cultural differences.
You're talking about health providers?
Yeah, I'm talking about doctors.
Doctors!
Doctors, nurses. they didn't trust them. And so they didn't trust the information that they got. They didn't feel like they understood them. And they didn't get a chance to talk with them a lot. So by involvement with the university and students from the university and trying to teach, it accomplished two things. They were able to teach students how they should be deal with communities and work in communities, but it also gave an opportunity for us to empower our residents in terms of what they needed to ask. Give them the to become comfortable with saying, I don't understand what you're saying to me. This medication is giving me problems. So, you know, we did medication assessments with them. We gave them a health card, so whenever they went to the doctor, they had a card, their questions on it, and the doctor was to put in their blood pressure reading and their blood sugar readings, or the A1C if they had taken that. And so we worked with both the providers and with the residents to get them comfortable with each other. And in the process, one of the things that the providers told us is that it made them better because they began to understand what it is that the people they were treating needed.
Interesting. That's an interesting story.
I'd like to say something.
Go ahead.
About the numbers.
Yeah.
So one of the this is a challenge sometimes in our work as a nonprofit organization is that we're trying to look at generational change. So what we want to do is dig deeper with maybe fewer people, but make a real change because what we see, and this is the interesting thing of working with mothers or pregnant women, if we make a change in the mom, it's going to change her child, which is going to change their child. And so the numbers might not be today. We might not do 100. And our numbers were smaller than we would have liked. And I think that's one of the issues I brought up about bureaucracy getting in the way in that, you know, it takes a while for an institution to change. So for the health clinic to enroll women in the program and monitor them and keep them incentivized to participate, you know, it was a new approach for them and they had to work out a lot of the kinks to make a change. And so they're still working on it and I know they'll get there, they're still committed to it, but it just took a little longer. But the depth of the change, I think, is something that we don't always consider. So
that's a good point. So who are we talking about? We're going to show you for 90 seconds some of the people who are involved in all of this and who are getting the benefit. So play away. Questions from the audience in just a minute, but watching this and listening to each other, is there anything you've seen or heard, any of you today, that sound like it's something that you hadn't heard before or that you could use in any of your programs?
I think that continuing with the idea of how do we on the ground continue to chip away at our health institutions and forming better relationships sounds like it's a recipe for success. And I think that that's something that, from just hearing the other stories and how that works, that's something that we're going to keep working on. And that's the sustainability of the work that we started. We're going to keep on making it happen.
I'm somewhat impressed by the pictures we just saw and some of your stories that seem to indicate that this is really working pretty well in a lot of cases, even though you've all expressed certain frustrations along the way. But is it working well? Are you making a dent? I mean, one of you started out by saying, well, we really have to address the problems of poverty, which, we could spend 4 days here on and not touch. But are we making a dent?
Well, at least in Boston, we have been BU and the American Heart Association are launching a program that's similar to the PRESTI program, even within some of the same developments that we're going to our PRESTI project. And within the health center, we do have a lot of initiatives, hypertension and other initiatives. What I noticed is that the hypertension classes occur around the same time that we have our aerobics classes. So they sort of we are having our program, so that our, you know, the residents are sort of participating in both programs now. So the family had detention classes where they learn information on cardiovascular diseases and such, and then they go over to our exercise program. So sort of spreading, you know, increasing awareness and, you know, spreading the types of programs within the community. So
I think we are making a dent because our residents and our members tell us that we're making a dent. When they put together their own skit and without any professional help and showed us how they felt we were doing, they told us that, hey, look, we enjoy this. We're bringing in other people to the program because we think that we need to change our lifestyle so that we can be healthier. One lady said on our video, she said, well, I gotta get my blood pressure and my diabetes under control because I gotta find a husband. So they are, you know, they come together and they become a family, and they're teaching other people the things that they're learning in their cooking classes. They're adapting the exercises to what they can do. They're in gardening programs, and they're integrating all of that together. And one of the things that we learned from them is that it was difficult to get people to come to continuous group classes, health education group classes. So what we did is integrate a health message into other activities. So it was short, it was brief, and it was like Jeopardy game that you put in for 5 minutes and then they could go on to their exercise or into their cooking class where they were learning things. So, and they remembered what they learned. It was interesting to them. But to just do a class, we were having not too great of a success.
I just have one little anecdote that psychologists was telling us that some of her patients were telling her to hurry up to go to the aerobics classes.
We haven't talked very much, except very peripherally, about safety and concerns over violence. I know in Arizona there are all these drunks in the park. How do you deal with that, and how do you deal with the police or the sheriff or who is ever in charge of that, and does it make a difference? Can you have an impact?
So safety has been an underlying aspect of this particular project because of, as Spencer mentioned, SG-1070 was coming into play right when we were doing our kind of intense community engagement effort, and what we were finding was, as he kind of alluded to, that people really just couldn't engage on a health idea when safety and their family, making sure that all their family members returned to home in the evening was the biggest thing that they could possibly think about and really make sure it happened. And so that was one component. And then as another component was really looking at recreation amenities and recreation and physical activity in communities. And some of the things that we found were that the BMX park that was put there was used for other social activity. And then he also mentioned the tennis court, which was a city-built structure and recreational amenity. And what we found was that what people were primarily using it for was for a beer garden during the Cinco de Mayo festival instead of what it was supposed to be used for. And so a lot of our research was looking into what were recreation amenities, how could we make them safer, how could we make them a default place to recreate and be together and to build community. And so much of our work was working on developing policy, and now you have to have a permit to have an open container in the park. And so that did allow for police departments to move intoxicants along if they couldn't demonstrate that they had a permit. But yet at the same time, it still allowed for fiestas and weddings to happen in the community parks. And so, so much of the work was just working with the community to find out what were the things that would make it safer for you. What would it make it so that you would be willing to send your kids there and not worry and not have just screen time in the afternoons, but have a chance to play in a park in your community and engage in your community the way you're supposed to.
Well, has it worked other than the permit for the alcohol? A drunk would have to have a permit? That's strange.
And what that allowed us to do was the law enforcement is now able to say to somebody, you know, you have a permit to have an alcohol container here today. You don't, so let's move along. You're going to need to find another place to be.
So other than that, how did you clean up the place? And I mean, did you turn the tennis court into a basketball court?
We haven't been able to do that, but we did engage the community so much that the city of Flagstaff has asked Edmond Savila in particular to work with the community on an engagement effort to redesign the park and make the park something that people will use more often.
Interesting. Okay, well, why don't we take a few questions from the audience in the time we have left, because you people are involved in all this. Yeah.
I have a quick question. Can I go back to your question about numbers? I think sometimes our funders drive the importance of the numbers, which is so significant. People talk about the depth, not just the money, but it doesn't seem like what you describe, the depth of your relationships and your collaborations, which many of our funders don't ask us to evaluate. Have you looked at all of your work to really show about
questions. Yeah. I think you all had a little bit different experiences with that. So, and that's a really good question. I was going to get to that eventually. So, yeah, let's talk about evaluations and sustainability of grants.
So, in our project, there's a couple ways that we've sustained the work. One is on a personal level with the women that we that were in our program. So, sort of, there's one woman who sort of personifies the success of this. So she started in the program. She came to every class we had. She redeemed every coupon she got. She paid attention to what the doctors told her in terms of eating healthier. She was very overweight when she started, and she was pregnant. Now she stayed with, so at the end of our program, we also gave a core group of moms an intensive nutrition education class so they could become peer-led nutrition educators. So she's really embraced that, and now she teaches weekly peer nutrition classes at the West Oakland Health Center. She's lost weight. She brings her children with her. So I think that working with her, you know, we sort of saw her really make a shift, and we're going to see that shift in two of her children. So that's one way that it sustains, because it's part of her culture now.
But I think the question had more to do with the grant and how long the grant. Does this woman get to stay in the program if the grant runs out?
She's still, well, actually, she's working for my nonprofit now.
Oh.
So we were able to transfer that to a job opportunity for her, those skills that she received. The second sustainability piece is that because we're a nonprofit partner and we have work on the street, we do a produce stand every week at the health center. So that keeps our relationship alive. It's part of the work that we do, and it will sustain beyond this funding. And so and this funding was 3 years.
So, with issue in Roxbury, we hope to sustain the program through what we call a medical fitness center. This is a place where patients, as part of the annual physical, the annual visits, will be given prescriptions to and referred to the medical fitness center. They will receive life coaching, acupuncture, or exercise, and other things like that. So we hope to sustain the program through the medical fitness center.
Our program is going to be sustained through our partners because none of the activities that we provided were provided directly by us. They were provided by our partners. So the Kidney Foundation, community health centers, and the rest will continue. What we did was recruit them to come on to the campus and to provide those services. One of the health plans is providing the exercise services. So they have found the benefit in that we can attract people to the campus to take part in the services. Whereas we had multiple resources within the community that people did not know about, and without being able to coordinate that and bring it all together in one place, the community felt like it did not have those resources. But now they know about the resources. The resources are pleased with the fact that the program can attract people to it. We have the commitment of our partner that owns the building to continue to allow those individual partners to come in and to participate in bringing their program to. And because they get the funding for those programs, it makes them successful, and in turn, it makes the community successful, and it makes us successful. So we don't compete with them for dollars for that. All we need is to be able to sustain the partnership and the collaboration and the newsletter communication.
So are you saying, in effect, that if the Kresge grant runs out or diminishes, that you've built enough partnerships in the community and got them going that they could sustain the programs?
They can sustain most of the aspects of the program. The part that may not be totally sustainable is that they like to have food at all of their events.
So do we. Well, remember I used a quote from one of you when we first started about how you come into the community and you leave a few years later and you're left, and people do this all the time. Does that model happen? Is that what's happening? Yeah, pass the mic down a little bit.
I'd just like to comment that because of the way that the funding was structured and because of the way that the project ended up kind of unfolding is that, Kresge really charged us with engaging a couple of safety net institutions. And because we're scrappy safety net institutions, we really spent a lot of time working together and trying to fold it into things that were already happening, or dovetailing on relationships that already existed. And because of that, the sustainability was a little bit more natural. So, because of relationships that existed and because of the strategies that were identified to be working and that community members really engaged with. And for those reasons, different strategies will continue.
Okay, go ahead.
Have you been able to engage the business community or private company? And if so, how did you show the validity of what you were doing?
we did that with a grocery store in West Oakland called Mandela Foods Cooperative. Part of our program was that the women were incentivized with coupons every month to purchase the produce. And the grocery store allowed the women to come in, and they and in fact, not only the grocery store, but also corner stores in the community. And the store owners would be very supportive of accepting these coupons. They would work with the women who were supposed to write down everything they bought to make sure that they were, filling out their forms. They were willing to accept these coupons and then wait sometimes 2-3 weeks before they got paid because they had to turn the coupon in, which then we had to write a check and pay them. So I think the business community, we were able to engage at least the retailers with the food aspect. The other business community we did with field trips, where we took, one of the things was community. Women wanted more community activities. So we took them to the East Bay Parks. We took them to the boathouse, and we did a boating ride and sang Christmas carols. We went to the farmer's market. So just engaging them in activities and businesses in their community was another way. So now they knew they could access those resources on their own.
You wanted to add to that?
Yeah.
The women, in order to qualify...
Well, we should explain what that is.
Women with is a California program that women have to be pregnant or breastfeeding. This one, and then CalFresh is basically the food stamp program.
The food stamp program.
So
yeah.
in our program, in order for the women to qualify to enroll in the program, they had to be WIC recipients and or be receiving... prenatal care, CPSC, I forget the first word in that, but it's prenatal services at the West Oakland Health Center.
Did they answer your question about businesses' involvement? Is that the kind of thing you were talking about?
But I was trying to see if they saw the validity of the program, if it was something that the businesses wanted to invest in long term.
What kind of businesses are you thinking about?
Well, she said something about the health insurance. So I was thinking of either health insurance type of services to put a dollar amount on the services that were being some kind of reimbursement.
Let's see.
Yeah.
We have a business. The Northtown Business Association is a member of our Impact community group, and so they've been involved in and will continue to be involved in the Greenway, maintaining the Greenway where our residents can walk, and they participate in a lot of our activities. In fact, our project manager is on the board of the Business Coalition. We also engaged the banks, and we even engaged McDonald's. They gave out coupons for salads and the kind of healthy eating piece alternatives that people could get at McDonald's. So they participated with us as well, and the local bank in the area has been involved. So the one thing that we're in the process of doing now, and our internal evaluator happens to be here this morning, is evaluating the change in the health status of the individuals who participated so that we can see whether we've had an impact in reducing weight and impact in reducing their blood sugar levels as well as their hypertension. So,
have you?
We're in the process. We have a lot of data on engagement and how many activities people took part in, and so we've gathered that data, and we have it in a database now that we're about to mine that database. We've used it previously to tell us what we should be doing, the database to say what people were interested in based on whether they were a business or whether they were individual, in order to change our program.
You would think that in order to reduce hypertension and reduce obesity, there are some general guidelines. Do you need data from 8 different organizations to make the generalities that you need to make to make the lifestyle changes?
Well, it depends on who you're talking to, who your audience is. Many of the health plans, they want to see hardcore data suggesting that there has been a decrease, and you have to be able to track those individuals. There's so many intervening variables in order to, because this is a community, it's not a research project.
That's right.
And so even when you talk to foundations and other funders, when they're looking for that data, they're looking for something that will require an experimental group and a control group. And you can never do that in a community because there are too many intervening factors that you can't control for.
Somebody over here had a question? Yeah. Oh, okay. Well,
we also had a credit union work with us. One of the things the women wanted was information about budgeting and managing money. So we had the credit union come in and do classes with the women, and then offer them the opportunity to open accounts, of course, at the credit union for $5. So I think that that was important.
Okay, so I'd like to ask a question or two about the evaluations. I mean, how do you know how you're doing? Do you need an outside evaluator? And is it sometimes more trouble than it's worth to gather all this data and so forth? Are evaluations a good thing or are they a hindrance?
Well, I think they're a good thing. I think that our the way that the project ended up unfolding was that we really prioritized evaluation from the beginning. So at MLW that had an internal evaluator, and then the Crescent Foundation also elected the external evaluator to look at the 8 different sites and some commonalities. Because some of the things that they requested of us from the beginning were that we involve the safety net entities, that there was a partnership, that there was community engagement, and that community health center was involved. And so we were able to look at all of those, but in our case, we really looked at the ripple effect pool, which I mentioned before, and then also policy development and policy change that would have a lasting impact and kind of move the needle for us. And so for those reasons, we were well positioned to be able to collect information about our impact.
Dana, how about you?
Yeah, I think if you care about the impact of the work you do, you have to evaluate it. And what is important is to evaluate throughout the project, not just once in the beginning and once at the end. You sort of have to do it throughout. And so because Alameda County Public Health was the lead agency in our program, they had evaluators working with us all through the project. And having some feedback mechanism, I think, is important, that if you're doing something that's not working, change it. Don't keep doing that, you know. So I think that you have to have evaluation. And then Kresge also had their level of evaluation of that.
Our evaluator is here.
Why don't you introduce yourself?
Yeah. Lauren Chance, and I work at the Center for Managing Chronic Disease at the University of Michigan. And I've had the pleasure of being involved in the evaluation across the sites of this work. And I think one of the things that is important to remind ourselves about this initiative is that we're working in times where there's a really big disconnect between clinical care and the community. And that when we focus on social determinants of health instead of just the clinical outcome itself, we realize, as somebody really put it well earlier, that you know, we have to look behind the scenes, behind the curtain, to see what is it that really gets in the way of people changing behaviors. So we can't just tell people change this behavior and then walk away thinking that they're going to do it. There's so many issues that get in the way of that. So one of the issues that has been at the forefront of this work is to create models that other people can use to understand how do we make these connections. In 3 years, we can't do it all. So it's like what other people were saying. We start small, we dig deep. We look at what the changes are, but we're looking at things like intermediate outcomes. We're looking at relationships that are built. We're looking at how do we get people from the clinic out to engage with community. We look at community partners that we already have and we build on them in ways that help individuals with their health. So I do think this project has demonstrated, and they talked about all these intermediate outcomes, and some of them have seen differences in the clinical outcomes too, but we didn't set out to measure those in the same way.
Interesting. It strikes me, and we were talking earlier about the clinics and the doctors and so forth, that if the doctors aren't doing their job and you go in there and you try to change that personal relationship, that seems to be fraught with some problems. I mean, the doctor going to say, yeah, I'm going to listen to these people? No. I mean, how does that work? How do you get them to change their MO, essentially?
Well, they will change based on what their patients push them to do. So that's one of the ways you get them to change, by educating and getting the individual to take charge of their own health care, to understand what their blood pressure reading means, and to get them to feel comfortable in asking their doctors what's going on and why am I feeling this way. And empowering them helps change the providers, and that's what our providers told us, is that they changed because their audience, their patients changed. Their patients pushed them to be better, and they really appreciate it.
And how did you get them to push, to make that step?
But we had individual one-on-one health days with individuals where we talked to them, we took their blood pressure, we did their blood sugar with them, taught them how to taught them about what their medications were, what they might be doing that was interfering with the medication, or maybe and we also put our pharmacists into the health center, and they allowed us to come in the waiting rooms to work with their patients. And we work with them to understand they might be providing too many medications. They have to begin to understand the person in the context of their environment, and that maybe you could do 10 medications as opposed to 15. And so by just giving them additional information about, well, if you prescribe a cholesterol medication that costs $200, this patient is not going to be able to afford it. Is there a substitute, a generic, that they could take that might do the same thing? We found that health center providers are very interested in connecting with their patient population and making changes. Electronic medical records have also helped in that process.
That's interesting. Good. Any other questions? One of the things we haven't talked about, though I mentioned at the beginning, was the difficulty of getting men into these programs. And almost all of you have been talking most of the day about women. Is this a problem, and is there a solution to it?
Well, with our women, this program, the women began from families and the exercise program. So eventually we saw babies, and then we saw the outcomes of the significant others coming. So women, the women who worked in the
program. Is this a problem, do you think? Not having men involved particularly?
Yes, because they are equally effective.
Yeah, I would think so.
High blood pressure,
diabetes and things like that. One of the things that our project in Hawaii told us was about a project they have where men get involved with a tool shop, and that's something that we have not been able to fund, so but we're very interested in exploring, because it is something that they're interested in terms of getting them involved in repairing things for different residents in the community. But the Hawaii project has been very successful in that area.
There was a question over here, or a comment.
I just wanted to make a comment on that, is that I think that is a big problem. I'm working in British Columbia, and this is not the health authority that I work in, but Northern Health. They have an amazing website on men's health, where everything is towards the man's health, because and how they see it. They've very much been engaging with some of the industries where they work in. There's a huge health disparity there, where men are definitely dying at a higher rate. So with the trucking industry, so the oil and gas industry, and that sort of thing. So I would recommend looking at Northern Health's website if you're interested in that.
All right, thank you.
One of the ways we engage the men, when we did the focus groups at the beginning, we invited families to come. So even though for this pilot the target was pregnant women, we did have husbands, boyfriends, whatever, come to the focus group and let us know what their issues were. And we invited them to any of the classes that we had. So we actually had one guy who went through the entire program with his girlfriend while she was pregnant. So, you know, that we had a little bit of that, but I think in general, at least what I've seen in the food world, we mostly see, you know, women involved with diet.
Okay, well, I think, let me reintroduce our panel and bring this to a close. A fascinating discussion. Amanda Guy from Flagstaff, Arizona. Dana Harvey from Alameda County, California. Crystal Palmer from Roxbury in Boston, and Lucille Smith from Detroit. Thank you very much. Interesting.